Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to this penultimate event in this series of key concept lectures. Our topic tonight is death, and you'll expect me to say that this was to be the last lecture in the series, but as far as key concepts are concerned, there will be life after death next week. It's a great pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Janan Ismail. Very newly arrived. She's been here just several months here at the University of Sydney, where she holds the very significant Queen Elizabeth II Research Fellowship in the Department of Philosophy and in its Centre for Time. You might recall we heard from the director of that centre, the Chalice Professor of Philosophy, Hugh Price, a couple of weeks ago. Before coming here, Janan was Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Arizona. So a slight climate change for you. She holds her first degree, Bachelor of Arts, from Reed College in the United States, and her Master of Arts and Doctor of Philosophy from Princeton University. Janan has held several prestigious awards, too many to mention now, but they include a Mellon postdoctoral fellowship held at Stanford University and a research fellowship at the US National Humanities Center. Janan's interests include, and they're very wide-ranging, and it's a broader list than this, but some of her interests include the philosophy of physics, the philosophy of mind, epistemology, the history of science, the philosophy of language, and the philosophy of social science. In the year 2000, she published a book entitled Essays on Symmetry, and I gather that there's a book nearly completed, maybe it's ready already, called The Situated Self, coming soon. Janan has kindly agreed to take your questions and comments at the end of the lecture, so I will invite her to speak to us now. Thank you.
Hear me now? Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the kind introduction and for the very kind invitation to speak after all of the other very distinguished speakers in the series. And thanks for all of you for coming out to hear about death after two very gloomy days of rain. Sort of heroic of you to even be here. But so I think death. We don't like to think about our death. And there are all kinds of cultural developments, social, technological, and economic, that make it possible to live without reminders of our mortality. We segregate the dying, we hide from ourselves the evidence of sickness, we live separately from our old people, we quarantine the dying in hospitals and hospices. It's impolite sometimes even to mention death in conversation. We view death not as a natural and inevitable stage of life, but as a calamity, a mistake, some kind of accident to be corrected. This attitude towards death isn't shared by all cultures, and even its relatively recent development in the West. But the result of it, I think, is a somewhat diminished appreciation of the finitude of life. We spend our lives, or at least some of us spend our lives, in the way a foolish man spends his fortune, as though there will always be more where that came from. Tolstoy, in The Death of Ivan Ilyich, perhaps the most famous literary portrait of the psychology of the dying man, captures how very easy it is, even though we all know, of course, in some intellectual sense, that we will die, to meet our ends with the sort of shock that the foolish spender feels when the last dollar is spent, with a sort of desperate plea as though nobody told me it was going to end. So, Ivan Ilyich, who has sustained a sort of mortal injury in some stupid household chore, I think it's putting up a curtain rod or something, When he begins to first acknowledge the signs of his impending death, thinks to himself, this is a quote from Tolstoy, in the depths of his heart he knew that he was dying. But not only was he not accustomed to the thought, he simply did not and could not grasp it. The syllogism he had learned from Kiesvetter's logic, Caius is a man, men are mortal, therefore Caius is mortal, had always seemed to him correct as applied to Caius, but certainly not as applied to himself. That Caius, man in the abstract, was mortal was perfectly correct. But he was not Caius, not an abstract man, but a creature quite separate from all others. Caius was really mortal, and it was right for him to die. But for me, for Ivan Ilyich, with all my thoughts and emotions, it's altogether a different matter. It cannot be that I ought to die. That would be too terrible. Okay. I think it's hard not to smile in recognition at the sentiment here. Part of what's being expressed is that even if we are, again, intellectually aware of the fact that people in general die, unless we've lived through, and here by lived through, I mean not simply that, you know, people sort of disappear into the machinery of hospitals, but I mean have gone through the process of dying with the dying. The death of so unless we've lived through in this sense, the deaths of people who are vividly present to us in all of their particularity as persons, persons with histories, the complex, altogether individual knot of memories, thoughts, experiences collected in an individual mind, I think it's really hard not to grasp that that could just end. What goes for the deaths of others, for those that we love, goes tenfold, of course, for our own deaths. Ilyich can fathom Caius's death because Caius is one man among many, barely a blip in the history of humanity. They're a zillion like Caius. They come and they go. But he, Ivan Ilyich, is something, again, altogether individual, irreplaceable, special, as he says, and this is continuing the quote. He had been little Vanya, with a mama and a papa, with Mitya and Volodya, and the toys and the coachman and the nurse, afterwards with Katenka, and with all the joys, griefs, and delights of childhood, boyhood, and youth. What did Caius know of the smell of that striped leather ball Vanya had been so fond of? Had Caius kissed his mother's hand like that? And did the silk of her dress rustle so for Caius? Had he rioted like that at school when the pastry was bad? Had Caius been in love like that? Could Caius preside at a session as he did? Okay. So acknowledgement of one's own mortality, if it comes, as it did for Ilyich, at the end of life, is very often followed by the thought, had I known, had I but known, really known, that I was going to die, I would have done things altogether differently. I would have spent my time, as the foolish youth says of his now vanished fortune, more carefully. You replay, I think, in your life, sorry, you replay your life in your mind, all of those wasted, sort of worthless moments, the hours in traffic, the useless minutes in waiting rooms, the time you spent with people that you don't particularly like. They stand out in sharp relief at the end of your life. It's a trite, but I think very familiar sentiment, heard time and again from people on their deathbeds, or people who've lived through sickness or mortal scare. The death of a loved one or someone who, with whom they identify closely. Again, this idea that I would have done things differently. I would have paid more attention had I known. It's as though the finiteness of the pile from which the moments of your life are drawn attached to them a value which they didn't have when you thought that there was an endless supply. Okay. As though value is measured negatively by the degree to which it diminishes the whole. If a dollar drawn from a Bill Gates-sized fortune is worth less than a dollar drawn from my pocket, a dollar drawn from a literally infinite supply is worthless because it leaves the pile undiminished. So this thought, I didn't really realize it was going to end if someone had just told me, if they had made me really understand that there wasn't always going to be more where this came from, that every moment in my life is drawn from an ever-diminishing pile, I would have done things differently. Okay. I think it reveals something important. It suggests that there's something to be gained by thinking about our deaths while we are living, that is to say, by adopting the perspective on our lives while we are making our choices that one has when one is surveying one's life in retrospect. So really my reason for wanting to talk about death is Well, first, that I really want to talk about life. And it's partly, but not wholly, intellectual. On the intellectual side, I think it really is difficult to grasp what it means to die. That is, there's an incoherence that's really not easy to ferret out in the idea of a state of non-existence when applied to oneself. But on the practical side, I think it has something important to teach us about life, and it will, and again, it will become clearer as I continue that I'm in large part, talking about life. Okay. So first, some questions about death. What is death? In purely forensic terms, the point of at which biological death occurs is hotly contested. Is it when the heart stops beating, when there's irreversible loss of brain function, when the body is not self-sustaining? Okay. Now, the question about biological death matters for many of the same reasons that the question about when exactly life begins matters, because it determines when laws and public policies that protect living persons are in play. What happens once the body ceases functioning, at whatever precise point that occurs, I don't pretend to know. It may be that we continue in some other form as souls or ghosts. One's attitude towards death will be shaped, I think, quite obviously, by one's beliefs about this. But what I'm going to suppose, and I acknowledge here just the hypothetical character of the supposition, is that death is the permanent and unequivocal end of one's existence. Okay? I'm going to suppose, that is to say, that death is an end, not merely a transition. Okay? So you may not believe this. There's nothing that I'm going to say that's going to challenge that belief. But as a hypothesis to be explored, that's what I'm supposing. What would it mean simply for your existence to end unequivocally and permanently? So on the hypothesis that death really is an end, what sort of a loss occurs when someone dies? Is it a loss that's redressed in any sense or redressable by a birth somewhere else, so long as the overall number of human lives is preserved? Continuing just with questions about death, is death to be feared? Who does death harm? It's not as though it hurts to be dead, right? Of course, it harms those who love and miss us, but that doesn't seem quite to bear the weight of the fear that we feel at our own death. What we're afraid of there is not that the people we love are going to miss us when we're gone. What exactly are we afraid of? Is it simply non-existence? Why are we filled with horror if that's the case? And why are we filled with horror at the thought that we might not exist a week or a year from now? But we're not filled with the same kind of horror at the thought that we didn't exist a week or a year before we were born. Okay? These are some of the questions that philosophers ask about death. And if you think about them for a moment, it will be clear that the answers aren't trivial. And they point to the fact that our cognitive and emotional attitudes towards death are murky and confused and not clear. To understand what it means for a conscious mental life to end, we have to understand what it means for it to continue. And we can take some clues here again, I think, from Tolstoy's Portrait. It's not an accident that when Ilyich thought of what it meant for him to die, what it would mean for his existence to end, his mind turned immediately to his memories, to the smell of the striped leather ball, and to the rustle of his mother's dress. These are the legacy of a history of personal experience. They're what connect little Vanya to the schoolboy who rioted when the pastry was bad, to the youth who loved recklessly, and to the magistrate presiding at session. What they all share is the memory of that striped leather ball and the rustle of his mother's dress. It's a fact about us, a fact about our psychologies, that we don't confront every moment with a clean psychological slate as though it were our first. The events of our lives leave an impression on our psychological slate that forms the backdrop for what follows. We carry our pasts with us, not just as a collection of what psychologists call episodic memories, that is to say, recollected images of past experiences, but in the form of a more or less explicit personal narrative, the story of our lives. And our understanding of that, the story of our lives, the trajectory that we've traced through history to get to where we are now, the things that have happened to us, right? That forms an important part of our conception of who we are. When we die, if death really is an end, the lines of memory that ensure the preservation of that history, the legacy of a history of personal experience, and that ensure the continuation of that story into the future, those are cut. For Ilyich, this means that when he dies, for example, there will be no one in the future who remembers the smell of the striped leather ball and the rustle of his mother's dress. Of course, some of the things that happened to Ilyich, others will remember. But memory is such a curious thing. There's such an inexhaustible qualitative and emotional richness to memories, especially the ones that I think we identify with and guard most closely. For example, the striped leather ball and the rustle of the mother's dress, those things were meant to evoke those precious, often incidental things that nobody else could really understand the significance of, things that are almost inseparable from the psychological context in which they're recalled. And those are the things that will be lost. And of course, it's not just the good things, the bad things too. And movie buffs here will be thinking of the sled in Citizen Kane, the sources of pain and emotional injury, small humiliations from childhood, the things that are like raw wounds. Those things, even if we're in some sense wish that they could be erased, those are the traces of our lives, right? And if they are erased, some part of us will be lost with them. So aside from that legacy, this sort of legacy of history of personal experience, when Ilyich dies, his death means that there will be also no one in the future to act on his present intentions. His hopes, fears, plans will go unanswered. His projects will go uncompleted. His relationships will be arrested. Everything in the works will be halted. Whether or not it has reached closure when Ilyich dies, that will be the end of his story. And again, there are similar qualifications to be made here. Maybe a colleague will finish his books. Maybe his children will be brought up by people that love them. Right? But again, I think to the extent to which those qualifications are correct, the extent that is to say that your projects will get completed by someone else after your death, I think they don't provide consolation for the extent to which it's true that they won't get completed. So again, what's being lost here when Ilyich dies is this sort of legacy of a history of personal experience and the fact that his projects and relationships, those things won't get continued. Of course, there's no loss on the material level when Ilyich dies. The matter of which the body is made is recycled in the form of energy, but it's a self-defining information that's stored in the brain that is lost, in the way that if you dismantle a computer, the matter of which the computer is made is preserved, it's recycled. Right? But the information stored in the files is lost. Loss of information is real loss. It's the only kind of real loss there is in a world in which matter and energy are conserved. Death, on the assumption that it really is an end, involves a clean sweep of the psychological slate. It's horrifying, at least in part, I want to suggest, because we identify with and preciously guard the information encoded in the soft structure between the ears, built up over a history of personal experience. And because we ordinarily have a lot invested in projects and relationships that we would like to continue. And they won't get continued after we die. No one, after you die, can write your book. The configuration of ideas encoded in the soft structure between your ears will be lost when the matter of which the brain is made disperses. No one will love your parents and your children and your spouse the way you do, because that love is inseparable from a history of shared experience. Unless we are all writing our very own remembrances of things past, our present hopes, intentions, plans, together with the legacy of our past, will be finally and irretrievably lost. Okay. It gets less gloomy. But all of this, I think, though, it does give us some clue about what makes a particular individual life uniquely valuable. That is why one death involves a loss that isn't redressed by a birth somewhere else. The value of a human life, unlike the value of a dollar bill, right, it's not fungible. Lives are not exchangeable for one another. If you think there's no loss when one person dies so long as another is born, you might as well just say that wouldn't have been a loss had Joyce's manuscripts been erased before they made it to press, so long as there is no loss in the overall amount of printed pages in the world. Or had Vermeer's portraits been destroyed, so long as there is no overall decrease in the amount of painted canvas. And I think utilitarians often speak as though lives were exchangeable in this way. It's the particular individual constellation of thoughts, experiences, attitudes, hopes, wishes, dreams, embodied in an individual human consciousness, what I've been calling the writing on the psychological slate, built up over the course of a lifetime, that's the locus of at least a good part of what we take to be valuable about a person. That's what is lost, what disappears from the world when a person dies. Just as it's a particular configuration of letters on the page or the particular arrangement of paint on the canvas that defines a lot of what we take to be valuable about Joyce's manuscripts or about Vermeer's portraits. And that's lost when the pages are erased or the canvas is painted over. An animal that doesn't carry its past with it in the way that we do, if it has a conception of self at all, has only the very thinnest conception of self. And when such a creature dies, there is a loss, but it's not the same sort of loss. Most pet owners are hard to convince that their pets aren't just bundles of trainable disposition. It's hard not to see your pet's responses to you as awareness of a narrative conception of your history together. But most people are happy to accept that when cockroaches die, there's no dissipation of the accumulated legacy of a lifetime and no unfinished business left behind. I think this also sheds light on why if you tell someone that they will not exist tomorrow or next year, they are horrified. But if you tell them that they didn't exist in the days or years preceding their birth, again, one of those puzzles that philosophers raise when they're worrying about death. But if you tell them that they didn't exist in the days or the years preceding their birth, they're unmoved. If the fear of death was the bare fear of non-existence, that asymmetry would be unexplained. We don't, but it's not. We don't just want to be alive. We want to continue our lives such as they are. We want to watch our children grow, finish our books. We want to live out the next stage in our marriages. We want to be there for our parents as they age. What we fear is a premature end to our personal stories. Okay. Tolstoy, and this is a part of what's being expressed in the story of Ivan Ilyich, had the idea that if life was finite, if we did really die, and death was an unequivocal and permanent end to our existence, it couldn't be meaningful. It's hard to turn the fact that we die into a valid argument for the absence of meaning or value, and philosophers are fond of picking apart all of the fallacies in some of the arguments that have been given. But I think the sentiment is familiar and robust, even in the face of demonstrated fallacies, and I think sometimes there's a deep truth behind robust sentiments of that kind. And the sentiment goes something like this. Our lives are full of effort, plans, calculation, hand-wringing over which path to take, devastation when things don't go our way. We live our lives with the most intense concern, treating ourselves and the choices we make as though they matter, as though something hinges on them. But, and the sentiment continues, all of our schemes are like paths leading nowhere. Life is no different than jumping off the Empire State Building, except that it takes a longer time to hit the ground. Okay. Tolstoy felt very deeply that the only solution was to deny, in fact, that life was finite. And for him, that took the form of religious faith. The existentialists had a different response, and I don't understand them, so I'm not going to talk about them, but much more common, I think, to the as a reply to this sort of sentiment is the reply of the hedonist, right, or hedonist. Even if life is finite, a cigar and a good Pinot Noir is still a good thing. Even a mortal man can enjoy a really good massage. Right? Those things don't require the support of eternity. In the words of Umar Khayyam, who has persuaded many a hedonist, "How sweet is mortal sovereignty," think some. Others, "How blessed paradise to come. Ah, take the cash in hand and wave the rest. Oh, brave the music of a distant drum." The idea here is that others look, as Tolstoy did, to the promise of a hereafter to make life meaningful. Khayyam recommends taking the cash in hand. Right? Again, the goodness of a good glass of decent Pinot Noir stands on its own. It doesn't require support from eternity. Right? Now, Tolstoy's reaction to this is that cigars and wine were a sort of ridiculous consolation for the injury of death. And his reply comes in the form of a very powerful image. And he writes, I don't know if you can all see this, he says, "There is an Eastern fable told long ago of a traveler overtaken on a plain by an enraged beast. Escaping from the beast," you can see sort of, once I finish this, the sort of difference in cultural mindset here. But, so escaping from the beast, he gets into a dry well, but sees at the bottom of the well a dragon that has opened its jaws to swallow him. And the unfortunate man, not daring to climb out lest he should be destroyed by the enraged beast, and not daring to leap to the bottom of the well lest he should be eaten by the dragon, seizes a twig growing in a crack in the well and clings to it. His hands are growing weaker, and he feels he will soon have to resign himself to the destruction that awaits him above or below, but still he clings on. Then he sees that two mice, a black one and a white one, go regularly round and round the stem of the twig to which he is clinging and gnaw at it. And soon the twig itself will snap, and he will fall into the dragon's jaws. The traveler sees this and knows that he will inevitably perish. But while still hanging, he looks around and he sees some drops of honey on the leaves of the twig, and he reaches them with his tongue and licks them. So you're supposed to be thinking here that the dragon at the bottom of the well is death, and the white and black mice that are twirling around the twig that he's clinging to and gnawing at it, those are the days and the nights that whittle away at the frail stem that separates him from death. And the honey, for which he reaches out with his tongue, those are the momentary pleasures of life that the hedonist is recommending is supposed to be sort of the consolation. And Tolstoy's claim here is that the momentary pleasures of life simply sort of lose their whatever intrinsic value you think that they might have had in the sort of context of a life that ends with death. Okay. And he concludes this rather ponderously, throwing off the mantle of the poet and donning that of the philosopher, I think rather pompously, he says, "And this is not a fable, but the real and unanswerable truth intelligible to all." Okay. So what I want to suggest here is that this dialectic is sort of the wrong way to think about things. The fact that we die means that our lives are framed. And frames maybe are something to be embraced. They are what allow life to have the complex internal architecture. That's a large part of what makes it interesting, exciting, frightening, and fascinating. It's what lends the choices that we make within a life moment. It's what makes it possible for a life to constitute a meaningful whole. That would be lost if the endpoints were given up. To get a feel for the importance of frames, think about what a really good meal is like. And here I don't mean a single course meal that's just taken to satisfy hunger, but the type of meal that raises dining to the level of an art. Meals, like lives, form discrete units. They have beginnings and endings and a natural lifespan determined by the combination of appetite and palate memory. The parts of a good meal are combined on the palate of the diner in the way the parts of life are combined in the memory of the person who lives it. A finely organized meal satisfies appetite, lasts as long as gustatory memory, and has a narrative or a dramatic arc of its own. The aperitif is taken within the gustatory scope of the entree, while the memory of the entree still lingers on the palate. And you get a complex development of tastes, layers, built on top of one another, textures, each adding to what preceded, creating expectations for what will follow, expectations which are either met or disappointed, maybe surprises along the way by what you actually are presented with. And a satisfying resolution that brings together sort of the threads that have been combined on the palate in the course of the meal. Now think what it would be like if we had to eat more or less continuously, so that meals weren't, in fact, discrete units, but bled off into one another without any natural boundaries, as though life were just one long, continuous meal. There are two ways this could work. Either we could suppose that we had an infinite gustatory memory, so that your palate retained flavors of an endless set of layers of strawberry on top of cod, on top of chocolate. Or you could suppose that memory had a horizon, retaining only flavors of some finite set of preceding gustatory experiences. The idea here would be that you're more or less always eating, but at any given time you're only retaining tastes that go back a fixed amount of time. Okay. In either case, though, there would only be one real beginning, back when you were in nappies eating mashed peas, and there would be no endings. Nappies is a new word for me, by the way. What there wouldn't be is any return to a state of gustatory innocence. There'd be no fresh palate, no rising crescendo of taste, textures, and smells, no denouement with a satisfying sense of completeness, no resolution. Okay? I think that's not something that we could want in the case of eating. We want discrete units. Beginnings and endings mean fresh starts, resolution, and closure. An endless life would be a little bit like an endless meal, an undifferentiated progression of one experience after another, without the arc of a life that starts with birth, progresses through the ordinary stages. It wouldn't exhibit the rise and fall, the crescendo and diminuendo of life as we know it. Okay? If someone offered you now a magical immortality-producing elixir that allowed you to live without physical degeneration forever, with the stipulation that once you made the choice, it couldn't be revoked. You'd be committed to really, genuinely infinite existence. Would you take it? And I encourage you here to think beyond the extra decade or two that, or three, that we would all of us like to have. But think about a literally infinite existence. In either of those scenarios, one where you had an infinite memory or just a memory horizon that faded off into the one end. Would immortality, in either of those cases, would it be a mixed blessing? Would it be a blessing at all? This is my one jokey slide. None of this, I think, detracts, of course, from wanting to live longer. I don't want to be sort of, well, I at least don't want to be finished with my life before I die. I want to retain the appetite for more right up until the end. Right? So even if you wouldn't take the elixir, the reply is here, but maybe it wouldn't be a bad thing to have a few extra decades. Okay. The point that I just made, put in abstract terms, is a topological one. A finite space or a finite life can have a more complex internal architecture than an infinite one, because points in a finite space can be differentiated by their relations to endpoints or boundaries. Okay. I think we can supplement that point in a way that provides an interesting counterpoint to Tolstoy's claim that a finite life would be meaningless if we turn to examples drawn from art, where the notion of meaning has a more natural application. What I'm going to propose is the fact that our lives are framed is essential to rendering them meaningful units. Okay. Ask yourself what makes a painting or a piece of sculpture or a story meaningful. When we talk about meaning in this way, I think we have in mind a sort of holistic dimension of value that's not reducible to the intrinsic qualities of the parts. To apprehend the meaning of a painting or a sculpture or a story, you need to survey the whole, to see how its parts are arranged. The meaning doesn't reside in any part of the painting, and it's not a matter of whether the parts are, as it were, intrinsically nice. This is what makes the artist's choice significant. Looking at a life as a whole and asking, was it meaningful? Does it add up to something? It's like looking at a story, a song, or a painting as a whole and asking whether it is meaningful. In abstract terms, we would say it adverts to holistic dimension of value, quite separate from and not reducible to the intrinsic qualities of the parts. The hedonist mistake, that is, the mistake of someone who thinks that the intrinsic value of a life is an aggregate of the intrinsic momentary pleasures of its constituent parts, is the mistake of thinking that you get the best song by stringing together the prettiest notes, or the best painting by arranging pretty colors on a canvas. If you apply at every point a local standard based on the quality of the notes, you'd end up, as children sometimes do, with a string of identical notes, just your favorite note over and over again, right? Or a canvas covered with your favorite shade. I think we see in this suggestion a potential alternative both to Tolstoy and the hedonist, that is, a conception of value that neither regards lives as meaningless unless we can see them as part of a divine plan, nor reduces the value of a life to an aggregate of separate momentary pleasures, that is, the hedonist's cigars and wine. When we ask of a life, was it well lived? We survey the whole, like Ivan Ilyich on his deathbed, and we consider it as a unit. We see the events that constitute the life together. We pull back from the concerns that drive day-to-day activity, and we ask whether there was some coherence to the life. A direction. Does it exhibit unity of character, a coherent set of values? Does it add up to something or express something worth expressing? Were there a lot of false starts, half-finished projects, wasted time, equivocal choices? We all know what a painting looks like when the painter didn't really know what he was doing. We've sat through movies that don't go anywhere or add up to anything. A life that's not well lived looks something like that. It's slapdash. Arbitrary, without theme or direction. It's not guided by and does not express an overarching idea or set of values. It doesn't express an integrated personality. Our lives take shape under our direction in something like the way a painting takes shape under the painter's brush or a sculpture under the artist's chisel. Our choices about how to fill the canvas of our lives, and it's important here that that canvas is finite, right? Our choices about who we are. Every stroke that's added gives our lives shape, and if we have an idea of what we'd like our lives to have looked like in the end, we should use them to bring it and ourselves into sharper focus. A life well lived always has an eye half cocked on the big picture, and it adapts itself to the shape and the size of the frame. If we think in these terms, I think we can make sense of a line of thought that leads from acknowledgement of death, of one's mortality, to an appreciation of life's value. Knowing that you have a finite amount of time forces you to use it wisely. In life, unlike art, there aren't really any do-overs. Every choice to X is simultaneously a choice not to Y or Z. You might yet Y or Z later, but eventually you run out of laters. In the end, the things that you might have done but didn't are things you didn't, period. Of course, the difficulty of all this is that we don't know at the outset how much canvas we actually have. There's a risk at any point in time of the brush being ripped from your hand. So there's this kind of epistemic dilemma of wanting to get enough on the canvas that at any given time, if the brush is ripped from your hand, there's enough on the canvas that it makes sense on its own. On the other hand, you want something always to be left to be completed, to fill up the rest of the canvas. You want projects in the works that depend on things to come later. That doesn't mean that the right way to approach living is to live each moment as though it were your last. That way, I think, lies the hedonist response, take the cash in hand. Nor, adamantly, am I recommending a life devoted to plans and projects at the expense of momentary pleasure. There's risk in long-term investment in an uncertain world, risk that you'll never realize the profits. There are really two separate dimensions of value here, neither reducible to the other. How you negotiate that practical dilemma, and that's the practical dilemma, I think, of living, right, is how you choose to live. These choices, big and small, fill up a life that's never guaranteed continuation beyond the present, and that is guaranteed eventual termination. So it's a trite, very trite, but heartfelt message. Life is short and precious. Be aware of its brevity and its preciousness, and its preciousness in part because of its brevity. Don't spend time on stupid things. Think about what matters to you. Do that. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much. And it's question time, so I'm sure there'll be lots. Who'd like to be the brave person to go first? Up here. Nick, he just...
I would have so much response, so I'll just maybe stick to one. If we make a thought experiment, probably people would divide in two categories, and I don't know how big, whether it will divide 50-50 or what would be the proportion. And so I'll invite your comment to it. What do you think it will be? If people were given a choice to live, but in a very different way that they are living now, so abandoning the projects and the way of life that they had, except that they will be living in a very different way, not the favorite way. And the second way, that someone will be like them, pursuing the same issues and the same plan, so that part will be satisfied, but they, as conscious being, will die. Which they would choose. And I'm just thinking, it's only while listening to you I realized that it is not purely theoretical as I thought of it all the time. That in fact in concentration camps, I think somehow people divided themselves because there were some who just wanted to survive no matter what. And others who thought life like this is meaningless. I'm not myself anymore. And I don't know what's the proportion. And anyway, how does it fit into what you're talking about?
So there were two things. I'm not sure that I understood. Is this still on? I'm not sure that I understood exactly what you were considering, but there were two things that I said that were important to preservation, that were importantly preserved when your life was preserved and not when you died. And one was the continuation of plans and projects and the fulfillment of present desires, wishes, hopes, and fears. And the other was this preservation of memories and the kind of legacy of a history of personal experience. In the case of concentration camps, you're right, people were sort of divorced from their plans and projects and so on, were cut off, and to some extent their personal relationships as well. But it's sort of a confused case in part because there was always the prospect for reconnecting up and continuing on with those. But in any case, one of the things that was preserved by them was this sort of legacy of a history of personal experience. And I think, you know, that is, the preservation of that, I think, is, you know, as important as, you know, the continuation of plans and projects and so on. I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know how people would react to given being faced with a choice like that. I don't know. And there's all, I mean, another thing too, there's kind of the brute just will to survive, and I think that's, it's like the appetite for life that's quite separate from either of those things.
Sorry, we both put our hands up at exactly the same time. I had an almost immediate reaction when you had the first quote up about not existing before we were born, because I have a reasonable familiarity, particularly with Buddhist frameworks, which have a sort of a paradoxical quality that on the one hand it is affirmed quite clearly that one exists before one is born, and that one has obviously a multiple and presumably infinite series of lives, but it is affirmed equally clearly that we die in every moment, and that what exists is in no sense permanent but is in a state of constant flux, with obviously birth and death acting as frames, as an infinite series of frames, but nonetheless frames within which we live our life. And that leads me to the second thought, and that is that when you see frames, frames suggest an outside to the frames. There is that which is within the frame, that which is framed, and there is a whole infinite universe which is outside the frames. The world does not stop at the frames. In fact, the frames precisely point beyond themselves.
Was there a question? I wasn't sure what...
I certainly want your response to what I'm suggesting. Perhaps you need to bracket them a bit separately, both that the Buddhist framework on the one hand and the point about frames on the other.
Okay. I was taking it for granted that as we conceive of our histories, we do conceive of them as embedded within a universe where time extends on both ends of the frame. So unless you're a solipsist, I was taking for granted that that's what death would mean, the non-continuation of my existence in the context of a larger world in which, you know, the people that I love and so on, you know, continued quite without me. In a solipsistic framework, I don't know how, you know, the notion of death doesn't make sense as far as I can tell. On the Buddhist, I'm not sure whether you were asking a question about that. I don't know a lot about Buddhist thought, but the idea that something continues in existence even though memories there's what I called a clean sweep of psychological slate at the beginning, at the end of a life.
Not necessarily a totally clean sweep, but over time, over 1, 2, 3 lifetimes, then everything is lost, except for the broader patterns of one's existence.
Two things that could happen. One is that there could be a kind of underlying continuant, a substance or some kind of enduring self that's present through multiple lives, and that's what provides the threads of continuity for multiple lives, even though memories are wiped out. Or there could be what you're suggesting, which is an actual retention in some, you know, subconscious form maybe of memory. Both of those are interesting hypotheses. I take it that there's a spectrum of, you know, possibilities, but if one conceives of death as really a clean sweep of the psychological slate, then I think, you know, much of what I said would apply. I don't know how it would carry over into those contexts.
I'm just wondering if this might translate into some sort of policy prescription that you would suggest. It seems to me that a huge amount of the world's resources are, in the next few years, going to be ploughed into keeping Caucasians alive for a long period of time, more or less satisfying, I guess, hedonistic desires of a particular section of the world's population. Could you perhaps suggest that an aesthetic alternative might be better, whereby we didn't keep white folks alive ad infinitum, and we shared the resources around a little bit more widely, and allowed other participants in humanity to better shape their lives?
Um, I don't know. I mean, these are very hard choices for precisely the reasons that I said about the value of an individual human life. I think, you know, there are no easy choices. I wouldn't want to recommend earlier death for my parents, for example, even though I'm vividly aware of the early deaths of vast numbers of people, you know, parts of the population. I just don't think there are easy answers. I don't know what I would recommend.
In relation to the finiteness of life, actually, in response to those who, especially mainly Christians, who thought that life wasn't much meaningful because it's short and finite, Bertrand Russell replied that most of the important things that we really value are finite things. So in a sense, quite contrary to the logic of Christianity, normally Nietzsche would say that they demean life because they think of it as a stage to the next life, but because it's finite, it has this meaning, and that's what Bertrand Russell was trying to say.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, think about the significance that, for example, the choice of, you know, someone to marry has. When you choose someone to marry, it precisely has the kind of weight and significance it does because you're choosing not to marry anyone else. And I think, you know, so many of our choices have the character. They have the moment that they do because precisely, you know, they are choices to do something that rules out doing other things. And I think, you know, choices just wouldn't have the same significance in the context of an infinite existence.
Yeah, that chap down the well, it would take someone with extraordinary composure of mind to reach out and enjoy what's there under those circumstances.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you think?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just in front of you. Yes. Yeah.
Death implies a self. So you can't have death unless it's death of something. So I was wondering if you could expand on the concept of self. Is, in your view, the self just a series of memories? Is it the narrative? It seems to me I remember myself as a child, and I remember my mother's dress, but somehow it just doesn't seem like me. You know, that's almost somebody else's life now. And is death an illusion because self is an illusion? And having said that, by the way, I'd quite happily continue to live and take the elixir. But
Oh, really? That's interesting. It's very perceptive of you to see behind this, you know, the deeper question of what exactly is continuing and what exactly is ending when a person, you know, dies or when a person continues to live. Nothing I said, I think, what I needn't defend, in order to defend what I've said, I needn't defend the identification of the self with, you know, what I call the accumulated body of memories or what you're calling personal narrative, in order to hold that preservation of that as part of what's sort of important about continuing to live. That said, my own view is, yeah, that we are the narrative. There are people, and I'm interested to hear sort of the personal psychology, your claim that sort of your past self is something, you know, distant cousin, you don't sort of identify with it strongly. People divide strongly over this. I mean, there are people, and there's, you know, philosophers too, who make this claim about, you know, about themselves, that they really do feel like a distant cousin to people who lie in the past of their, you know, in their own past. And there are other people who claim to have identify very strongly, and I think it depends to some extent on the extent to which you have plans and projects that unite you, or, you know, personal relationships that have continued throughout that time. So I think, I really do think that it's a very personal question, the extent to which your narrative is unified by and the parts of your lives that are unified by the narrative threads that are currently active. I wouldn't take the elixir.
Perhaps just a couple more. There's one towards the back.
Water, that colorless, priceless, tasteless solution, has always represented life. And water, as we all know, physically speaking, is an eternal solution that doesn't finish or even decrease. And since it represents life, do you think there is any symbolism that life itself is eternal, irrespective of the state or the form it takes?
Whose life? I mean, that's part of the question. This life in general, or
life in general. I mean, wherever there is water, there is life. Like, for example, if they say on Mars we found a drop of water, then it means that there is life on Mars. Life in general, whether it's the human life or animal life or plant life, is always represented by water, symbolically and physically. And I find an extreme similarity of the symbolism, that if water is in itself eternal, then life in its current contemporary form must be eternal, because water becomes steam, and the steam goes down to the ocean and it goes back, and it's a fairly eternal solution that doesn't decrease or increase. And since life is always represented by water, there must be some meaning behind that life which we live now, and it must be somehow eternal, since water is eternal and it's the only symbol of life.
Maybe. I'm such a literalist about these things that I don't know what to say. Maybe.
I think we're done. One more down here, Nick. Thanks. Is that it then? So we can line up the mic. Yes, thank you.
Hi. My question's not very clear, but I'll feel through it. Now, you said two things. One is that about the finiteness. Now, that's fairly clear, because you've got a singularity at one end, then you've got infinite entropy at the other end, and so you have to have intelligibility that has to fit in between. So if you want intelligible information, it has to be finite. Okay, that's got to be between the two ends.
I'm not sure why you say a singularity at one end.
Okay, I'll use an analogy, the Big Bang. Okay, you've got your singularity type thing there, and then you go off into maximum infinite entropy at the other end. So,
but you don't, I mean, you don't need anything quite that fancy. I mean, I was just talking about an internal arc.
Yeah, yeah, but
two endpoints, but in that an frame, increase in internal complexity.
Yeah, but in that framework, you're forced to see that you need intelligibility has to be a finite sort of situation between the two. So, but on the other hand, you've got the point is maybe related to that what the other person said. That's fairly sort of obvious, but it's the experience of life and death.
I didn't hear that.
No, it's the experiencing of life and death that actually is what makes life and death interesting. Now, for example, you spoke about death in the sense of a loss, but there are also people who think of death in the sense of gain. So could you comment on death as gain?
First, to go back to the earlier point, the kind of architecture that I take it that a life has was really nothing so fancy as a singularity on one end and an increase in entropy. It was just literally the idea that, look, you have a blank kind of structure, right? So a sort of blank structure plus an increase in complexity simply in virtue of the fact that information is being gained at each stage and stored. And then the idea that there's an endpoint on the other end, you know, allows you to have the kind of, you know, build in information that's retained up until a point, and then there's just loss, you know, when the increase in complexity ended. And the suggestion about the possibility of immortality is precisely the suggestion that just layer on top of layer and an endless increase in complexity would be a very different sort of structure than the kind that we actually have, and maybe not a desirable one. So going back to about, you know, the possibility of conceiving of death as a kind of gain, what did you have in mind? What I wasn't sure.
I don't know. Suicide bomber, perhaps. A suicide bomber. That's the most obvious example that comes to mind.
someone who...
But on the other hand, there are also lots of religious persons who say the same thing. I just thought of this as well. So maybe you could
those,
mix the
I
two.
Think,
yeah.
But those are people, if I understand properly, those are people who don't think of life as an end. They think of it as a transition. So they expect the continuation of their consciousness, but just in another form, sort of like moving somewhere else.
But that's relating it to what the person said over there about a meaningful life versus a meaningless life. So if life is, some people might say it's gain to lose a meaningless life, whereas it is only a loss to lose a meaningful life. But on the other hand, so I'm going down that sort of line.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that way. Thank you.
Okay, I think we're done. Thank you. Before I ask you to thank Janan, just two quick points. Some people have inquired about reviewing each lecture, and if you visit the RIS website, and our literature is at the back, just click on events and you'll find a podcast of each of our lectures. In fact, tonight's lecture will be up at about 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. So if there are any of the lectures in the series you'd like to review, you can listen to them at your leisure. And this is one lecture I'd love to hear again, so I will. Next week, Globalization, Professor Raewyn Connell, who publishes as R.W. Connell, will present the final lecture. And if you're coming and want to factor it in, we will give you a drink afterwards. But in the meantime, please join me in thanking Janan for tonight.